me introduce the next case. The third case is 2013 AP 843 CR, State versus Danny Robert Alexander. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Thomas J. Balestrieri. He has 25 minutes. Then we're going to hear from Matthew S. Pinnix, who represents Danny Robert Alexander, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal from Mr. Balestrieri. Mr. Balestrieri.
Thank you. Let me first say what I am not arguing here today. I am not arguing that when you have a situation like we have in this case, where there was a forfeiture of a claim of error in the circuit court by failure to object to the potential error, that the Court of Appeals has no power to deal with that forfeiture sua sponte by means of addressing that claim under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to object. What I am arguing—
Why don't you state it positively? If
the court has, all right, the Court of Appeals does have power to address a forfeiture by means of a rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel, even when the claim of ineffective assistance has not been raised in the circuit court. They have that power.
I'm glad you say that, because they do it with some frequency.
Yes, they do. What I am arguing here today is how the Court of Appeals should exercise that power that it has to deal with a forfeiture by means of ineffective assistance of counsel. I do not think that the Court of Appeals should deal with that kind of a claim the way it dealt with that claim in this case, and that is to simply decide the claim of ineffective assistance without giving either of the parties any opportunity to address that claim, to make legal arguments on that claim, and in particular, to address that claim without having a hearing in the circuit court where all of the facts necessary to determine a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel could be developed. And what I am suggesting—
Is that going to be a Mockner hearing, a late Mockner hearing? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's exactly what I'm saying. If the Court of Appeals wants to address a forfeiture by deciding the claim as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, what it should do is, under its authority, to remand cases to the Court of Appeals for determination of factual issues while the appeal is still pending. They should do that.
Who's they? Remand to the Court of Appeals? No.
I misspoke. Remand to the circuit court. They should exercise that power, remand it to the circuit court for an appropriate hearing to determine all of the facts necessary to appropriately decide a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Mr. B, is the argument that you're making now a modification of the argument in your brief?
Well, I have to concede to you that in my opening brief, I was a little ambivalent. If you read some parts of it, I seem to be saying, they shouldn't even decide this. In other parts, I seem to be saying they should send it back. I hope that in my reply brief that I clearly explained, or more clearly explained, my position, which was if they want to decide the case as an ineffective assistance case, they ought to send it back for a hearing.
Well, that's page one, is it, of your reply?
Yeah, I started right out in my reply brief.
This case is not about whether an appellate court has the power to consider the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel on its own initiative but about how the power should be exercised. That's how you started today.
Yeah, and that's my clarified position.
Does that also differ from the issues set forth in the petition for review for which we took the case?
No, it doesn't. No. Mm-hmm. I think the way I stated it clearly covers my position. There are two reasons why I think the Court of Appeals should not just go ahead and decide the issue of ineffective assistance on its own without a Markman hearing.
What are the facts that are missing here, Counselor?
Well, we don't know. We don't know, for example, whether or not trial counsel's lack of objection was a strategic lack of objection. We don't know if he just missed it, or we don't know whether he saw the problem with the pre-sentence report and decided for strategic reasons not to object.
Well, the judge spoke with him about it. He said that he read it to his client. His client answered positively, saying, yes, he had seen the PSI as well.
I'm sure everybody saw the PSI, but we don't know. We don't know, and we know that trial counsel did not object after seeing the PSI.
Right.
What we don't know is exactly why trial counsel decided not to object. We don't know if it was a strategic decision that he felt either that what was the objectionable parts of the PSI were actually helpful to the defendant. We don't know if he just missed it, which is kind of hard to believe because
it's
right up there on the top of those particular pages it says this is not admissible. You can't use it. So that's what we don't know. We don't know why he did not object.
You know, if you look at the Court of Appeals dissent, it doesn't matter, because the Circuit Court itself, in its full statement, made a factual statement about relying on information that has nothing to do with the complaint before us. Right?
If you follow the dissent, yes.
Right. So I think it depends on which way you're going. Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah. Actually, Justice Rogensack, I'm going both ways.
Well, that's not a surprise, but.
I am saying that the court should never have decided this on the grounds of ineffective assistance to begin with, and then I'm saying that if you go with the trial court's explanation, its statement that there was other evidence in the record, even if you go under a rubric of ineffective assistance, that under the dissenting's view, that would show that there's no harm. Even if you do decide the case as an ineffective assistance case.
The trial court said it knew this material anyway. Right?
I'm sorry?
The trial court said it knew this.
Yes, the trial court said it was aware of the fact that Mr. Alexander had committed additional offenses, had uttered additional forged checks.
Is that in the record, how the trial court would have known that?
Well, the trial court said it would have known that from other parts of the PSI in particular that were completely divorced from the two statements that were attached as appendices to the PSI, which were compelled statements. Plus, in particular, the victim impact statement here, where the bank official indicated that there were a whole bunch of other forgeries other than the two forgeries that the defendant was convicted of. So this was basically a check cashing scheme involving mm-hmm. a number of people, the defendant being only one of those people. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Didn't the circuit court say at one point that this was harmless error at best?
Yes, it said that, and the reason being that the court said that it already knew mm-hmm. the information that was contained in the in those prohibited attachments to the PSI.
From your point of view, is that a better approach for us to take than looking at a remand for a Mochner hearing?
Let me give you an answer in two parts.
Okay.
Number one, I would like you to, as a matter of law, say that in most cases where the Court of Appeals wants to take up the issue of ineffective assistance, it should remand for a Mochner hearing. In this particular case, I don't think that's absolutely necessary because you can find lack of prejudice if you go with the circuit court's statement that it already knew the information that counsel didn't object to.
And that's what the dissent at the Court of Appeals...
That's what the dissent said, yes. That's what Judge Fine said.
Mm-hmm. What
is the information that the circuit court already knew? I mean, after all, here is the sheet, and it talks about Dave's machine repair and some forged checks. Now, what is the information that the court already knew about those forged checks?
I don't think that the court was necessarily saying that it knew about those specific forged checks that were contained in the those attachments to the PSI. I think what the circuit court was saying was that it was well aware that whether you look at those particular Dave's machine forged checks or not, it was well aware that the defendant had been involved in uttering forged checks in addition to the ones that he was convicted of, that there were more forged checks out there that he was involved in uttering.
Didn't the court also point out that the checks of which he was convicted in the case before us totaled a little more than $3,000, but the court had information that there were over $9,600-some of forged checks in total.
Right.
So
yeah,
when you subtract one from the other, there are some others that are out there.
Yeah, that was the basic reasoning. And in fact, there was some indication in the PSI that it may have been as much as 12,000 total.
Mm-hmm.
At least 9, but maybe 12. And that's basically what the circuit court was relying on, was saying, hey, look, U.S. Bank has been defrauded here of at least $9,000. This guy is involved in a check cashing scheme. The two checks that we have total $3,000, but there's at least another $6,000 out there that he's involved with.
When did the trial court say all this?
This was in its decision rejecting the post-conviction motion.
Okay, what was the basis of the post-conviction motion?
The basis of the post-conviction motion was that it was error to include in the PSI these two previous statements that the defendant had made in the revocation proceedings that were actually immunized and could not be used at the sentencing.
But it was not a challenge to the counsel.
There was never a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel here. And I will add that the issue on appeal was the same thing. It was a straight up challenge to the inclusion in the PSI of these compelled immunized statements and an allegation that was reversible error.
And did different counsel represent the defendant at different proceedings? We've got the original conviction, we've got the post-conviction remedy, and now we have the appeal to the Court of Appeals and the review here.
Right. So we've had three different attorneys.
That's what I'm asking you.
At trial and the post-conviction and the post-conviction and appeal to the Court of Appeals, attorney two, attorney three, Mr. Penix, representing Alexander here in this court.
Counsel, now that you have... Are you finished?
Mm-hmm.
That you've clarified what you're arguing and not arguing, I wonder what law development there is in this case. As I understand, the rule that you're espousing is in most cases where the Court of Appeals wants to take up ineffective assistance of counsel sui sponte, they really should remand. But in this case, they don't need to. So what kind of law
As far as the law development, two parts to my argument. Again, as I said.
But your argument is no longer that taking it up sui sponte conflicts with the established law that requires ineffective assistance claim to be raised in the first instance by the parties in the circuit court. You're not arguing that any longer.
Oh, yes, I am.
Oh, you are.
Oh, yeah.
So they shouldn't take it up at all. They should just remand. In fact, they should just remand the issue totally, right? I mean, they shouldn't take it up at all.
That's what the Court of Appeals should have done, yeah.
Uh-huh.
When they looked at it and they said, oh, we've got a forfeiture here.
Mm-hmm.
Ineffective assistance of counsel is the established means of circumventing a forfeiture. They should have, at that point, remanded the case to the circuit court for a Mockner hearing on the claim of ineffective assistance.
But if nobody'd raised ineffective assistance, why in the world are they having a Mockner hearing? Just because you have a forfeiture, we have a lot of things that are forfeitures.
It's not that nobody, it's that the parties didn't raise the claim of ineffective.
But at the point that the court would refer it back, it would be for its decision, and at that point, nobody had raised ineffective assistance, if I understand how you began, correct?
Neither of the parties ever raised ineffective assistance.
Well, I know they never did ever, but what I'm saying is, well, never mind.
It was the Court of Appeals. Let me just.
They said it in their opinion. I get that. I read
it. Yeah, it was the Court of Appeals that raised the issue of ineffective assistance.
But there are times when there are forfeiture, and you don't necessarily use ineffective assistance. Now, in this case, it seems to be the best route to have used. According to both the dissent and the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals. But we have other forfeitures, and we don't send them all back for a Mockner hearing just because there's a forfeiture. Got to have more than that. Mockner is tied to ineffective assistance. So, you know, we're not going to have a rule that's going to come out and say anytime there's a forfeiture, you got to remand it back to the circuit court for a Mockner hearing. And the Chief Justice wrote a exposition on forfeiture and how you recognize it and what you do with it. And we didn't send it back to the trial court to have a Mockner hearing.
There are different ways of dealing with forfeitures.
Right.
One is to ignore the forfeiture.
Perhaps.
And just go right to the merits of the issue. That's one way of doing it. In most cases, that's not really a very good way of doing it.
Aren't you limiting your argument to ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, I'm limiting my argument to the facts of this case, right?
That's right.
That where the court decides that it's not going to just simply ignore the forfeiture, but it's going to deal with the forfeiture as a claim of ineffective assistance, then that has not been raised. Then when the court decides that it wants to deal with the forfeiture as an issue of ineffective assistance, it should not simply decide that issue of ineffective assistance on its own without input from the parties and without an evidentiary hearing.
Let me ask it in a different way. They could have ignored the fact that there was a forfeiture and said it's within their discretion to reach the issue of whether the trial court should have used this PSI, this declaration.
That would have been one way of dealing with the forfeiture, yes.
That's right. And then what would have happened? Do you need a Mockner?
Well, you would not have needed a Mockner hearing if they decided to deal with the issue on the merits by ignoring the forfeiture.
That's right.
But,
okay.
I mean, I caution.
But they could have done that.
That is one thing they could have done.
Yeah.
All right. Now, if you'd like me to address why it was not a good idea to do that.
Why don't you do that?
I would be happy to. the reason that it's not a good idea, there are a couple of reasons why it's not a good idea to simply ignore forfeiture, is that first of all, We don't know, without a Mockner hearing, why counsel didn't object. We don't know if it was just an error on his part, whether it was just inattentiveness, or whether it was, in fact, a strategic decision.
Oh, we're not doing it on any effective assistance of counsel. We're saying
that the trial court,
as a matter of law, I mean, that's the issue, as a matter of law, should not have gone to these documents.
We can't say that as a matter of law if, in fact, there was a strategic decision not to object. You can't say that. There is no error as a matter of law if an attorney, as a matter of strategy, knows that there is a problem and as a matter of strategy decides not to object to that problem because he thinks it's in the interest of his client not to object.
It's nothing to do with his client. It has to do with the power of the judge.
Counsel, do you think victim rights compliance occurred in this case?
Victim rights?
The judge has to make sure the state has complied with victim rights and the victim has to have the opportunity to be heard. What did the victim say here?
The victim was U.S. Bank.
Right.
Okay, so it's not our usual individual.
I know, but
victim.
What did they say? Did the victim bring up, gee, we have $9,000 here? Was there an alternative source for the judge's knowledge other than the defendant's statements?
Yeah, the victim, U.S. Bank, submitted a victim impact statement saying we've been defrauded. And actually, the security officer for U.S. Bank actually kind of went on and said, you know, we're tired of this. We've been defrauded now. This is a gang that's doing this. This has got to stop. And they were pretty clear that...
And they have the right to make those statements.
And they certainly did have a right.
And so why wouldn't that be an alternative source of information?
Oh, it was. That's what the judge said.
Okay.
Yeah. That it was an alternative source. But the other problem with simply ignoring the forfeiture and getting to the alleged error is not just that it may not have been an error, it may have been a strategic decision not to object. The other thing is that if you just get to the error without a claim of ineffective assistance, without treating it as an ineffective assistance, the state has the burden to show that the error is harmless. Now, the state may not be able to do that if the record is not developed. The easiest example would be a claim where hearsay evidence was introduced. We have a hearsay witness saying something. If I could just finish up. I see my red card is on.
You may finish.
We have a hearsay witness saying something, and it's hearsay, and it's error. But in fact, the state's got 10 other witnesses. But that doesn't appear on the record if you just address the claim on the basis of the record made in the circuit court. That's why we need a hearing, so that all of these facts can come out, whether there was a strategic objection, whether or not there were facts not appearing in the record that make the error harmless. So thank you.
Thank you
for letting me go over my red card.
We have 5 minutes in rebuttal. you are Mr. Penix, and you represent Mr. Alexander.
Yes, ma'am.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. May it please the court, as the Chief Justice said, I am Matthew Penix and I speak for Mr. Alexander. Mr. Alexander asks this court to affirm the holding of the Court of Appeals on two grounds. First, that it rightly reached and decided the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, and alternatively, that if it somehow erred in that regard, the holding can nonetheless be affirmed on the basis of plain error insofar it was plainly erroneous to submit his statements to the circuit court and for the circuit court to rely upon them when sentencing him. Mr. Alexander asked this court to return him to the position he would be in if his counsel had objected at his sentencing hearing to the inclusion of protected statements in his PSI, which would have...
Mr. Pinnock, if the claim is alleged ineffective assistance of counsel, what's unreasonable about what Mr. Balistrieri is suggesting, that it go back to the trial court as it would in any other instance where ineffective assistance of counsel is alleged for a Mockner hearing, to give the state the opportunity to explore whether it was the product of a strategic decision or plain error, to kind of use your phrase?
Well, first, Your Honor, I think that this is the type of case that I have argued for in the briefing that qualifies for one of the rare exceptions where a hearing is unnecessary because the record...
Because it's your client?
No, Your Honor, I think that the record clearly demonstrates the fact that there's no objectively reasonable basis on which counsel could have acted in the way that he did in this particular case.
How on earth would you know that?
I think the record is clear, Your Honor. There's, as the Court of Appeals said...
Just because you think it, why shouldn't the state have the opportunity to explore it?
Well, I'm sorry.
Please, go ahead.
If I may just briefly note, the burden in an ineffective assistance of counsel case falls on the defendant and not on the state. So the state bears no need to go rummaging around. It's the defendant's responsibility to demonstrate to the reviewing court that, in fact, the deficiency was present. So the defendant in this case can demonstrate to the court by reliance solely upon the record that his counsel acted deficiently by not objecting to statements that should never have been included, and that there is, as I set forth in the brief, no reason to allow otherwise unknown criminal actions to be presented to a sentencing court at the time of sentencing if there is no other way but for the constitutional violation for the court to become aware of that information.
What about the victim impact statement from U.S. Bank?
I think it's important that we look at both what the court said at the sentencing hearing as well as what the court said in its post-conviction decision. And at the sentencing hearing, in possession of all the information that it later had at the same time that it decided the post-conviction motion, the court says to Mr. Alexander, look, I can't tell you from this information what you've done. The materials submitted to me from U.S. Bank do not allow me to understand your involvement. We then later see in the post-conviction decision a different statement from the court saying, oh, I knew all this already. And that is the discrepancy that Mr. Alexander points to highlight the clear error in the conclusion that the dissent in the Court of Appeals is proposing, that the court knew of it otherwise. There's no assertion in the, and I disagree with the characterization by the state of what the court was relying on in its decision. I think that the court was reading everything together, not picking out piecemeal parts of the victim impact statement or Mr. Alexander's statement, but rather reading them all together and using that to say, I already knew about it. But what we're suggesting is that the reliance on the information in his statements should never have been part of that metric, because it's a violation of his constitutional rights in the first place for the sentencing court to be using it as a basis for understanding what Mr. Alexander did. That is where we get to the prejudice component. So given, and if I may just go back to the deficiency analysis, you know, the only way that the sentencing court knew what Mr. Alexander did was by his own statements that were attached to the PSI. And the statements that he made to his probation agent laid out in detail his other criminal acts besides the one to which he had pled guilty. So the court has in front of it information it would not otherwise have had. And the victim impact statement, as well as the statements that the victim made to the PSI writer, are nonspecific as to Mr. Alexander. They're vague as to this group of individuals not defined, not described, have defrauded us a certain amount of money without laying out with any particularity what amount of money Mr. Alexander was responsible for. So there's no objectively reasonable basis on which counsel could have allowed Mr. Alexander's statements into the record to demonstrate to the court, here's how bad a person I am, Judge. And if I may just follow up on that, even if we are to suppose that perhaps, as the state has argued, defense counsel was attempting to mitigate his client's history to show that he was somehow contrite or otherwise accepting responsibility, we can see from this argument that counsel made that he completely failed in that regard. Insofar as he says, look at the PSI, Judge. It demonstrates Mr. Alexander's cavalier attitude towards crime. If it had been counsel's strategic decision to use his statements to advance his client's argument at sentencing for something less, then he failed completely, and the record demonstrates that. What possibly can counsel come in now and say that would be a sufficient, objectively reasonable basis on which to conclude that his choice not to object was reasonable?
Well, counselor, if he's part of a check-cashing scheme, and that, I think you've said, is why you think the numbers that are in the record are not persuasive, I still don't think that gets you where you want to go, because the checks for which he was convicted are a little more than $3,100, and there's at least $9,626 that U.S. Bank says in their impact statement that have resulted from fraudulent checks. Forget the interest and some other things that they would tack on. So to say it didn't say he wrote these checks, I don't think it gets you where you want to go. I mean, we have party to the crime statutes all the time. And so if he's involved in a check cashing scheme, I'm not sure that it's necessary that the court should have been told the difference, the 6,000 difference that we have here, a little more than that, was from his sole activities. I'm not sure that I see why that's important.
He's involved in a check cashing scheme is a conclusion reached by his statements that he gave to his pre-sentence investigation writer that included defrauding not only the Silver Mill Management Company, which is referenced in the victim impact statement, but also Dave's Machine Repair and then David J. Frank.
What did the victim impact statement say?
The victim impact statement says that there's about $9,000+ defrauded against the Silver Mill Management Company.
Yeah, 96.
By the defendant?
Wait, do you have the words?
Yes, I do. It says, and may I just clarify, Your Honor, are you asking me about the document entitled the victim impact statement? Or are you asking me about the statements included in the PSI that were made by the victim?
Either.
Okay.
Because those are both properly before the court, right?
That's right.
Yes, and if I may, that they differ. And they differ in significant respects, such that the sentencing court at the time of sentencing said the information that's been provided to me by this victim doesn't allow me, Mr. Alexander, to understand your involvement in any additional criminal activity.
Why don't you read both, if they're different?
I'll start with the,
excuse me. Are they in the appendix?
I do not believe they are in the appendix.
Okay.
May I just?
Go ahead.
The victim impact statement reads, yes.
Which one is this?
This is the February 21st, 2012 filed victim witness services document that was supplemented to the record by our request.
At sentencing?
And it was submitted at sentencing, yes.
Okay.
It reads, yes, U.S. Bank suffered a financial loss of $9,600 due to counterfeit checks cashed against Silver Mill Management LLC. Danny Alexander cashed two of them for $3,200. There's a few other derogatory statements aimed at Mr. Alexander that don't talk about the amount of loss.
So it says Alexander had the $3,200, but they suffered a larger loss, right?
Yes, and then the...
But the larger loss is tied to him somehow, or they're just saying...
I can only read this to you, and then maybe we can talk about it a little further. This is from the PSI, and I believe I can read it to this court. In open court. as it requested. The victim impact statement reads as follows. Mr. Harlan Peterson, senior fraud investigator for U.S. Bank Corporation, was interviewed for the PSI. Mr. Peterson stated that he has been highly involved in this case as there were several checks cashed by several suspects in a ring of fraudulent activities involving area businesses and U.S. Bank, as well as other financial institutions. Mr. Peterson stated, I'm tired of the Danny Alexanders of the world who come into our banks and have the audacity to cash as many fraudulent checks as they want and leave. They are caught because they usually don't care if they get caught. But at sentencing, the defense attorney will say, well, it's only a couple of thousand dollars. Well, here we, U.S. Bank, have a total loss of $12,000 from Danny and his accomplices. And that's just us. There are other victims here and other pending cases. And then he goes on to say a few more disparaging remarks about Mr.
So he ties it to Danny. Danny is your client, right?
That's correct, yes.
So the PSI, your argument, if I hear you, is PSA ties the large loss of 10 to Danny and his accomplices, but the victim impact statement just attributes $3,000 to Alexander.
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, that's how you interpret these documents.
That's correct, and I believe...
Do you think the victim's precluded from talking to the PSI writer and making that statement?
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. I just thought the chief was suggesting only one of those is really in a victim impact statement.
No, I'm trying to say that one of them is attached to the PSI and the other one isn't.
Yes, one of them is a summary included in the PSI, and the other one is a document that was completed by the same investigator that gave the statement to the PSI writer. So, in fact, even the same individual is making different claims about the amounts. And where I think this is relevant and why I think this is important to prejudice is because what we're talking about is the court's suggestion that it otherwise knew of it, that there's no prejudice here because I knew of this already. But
well, the court at least knew there was 12 grand that someone from U.S. Bank thought this defendant had some role in creating that loss.
Well,
that's appropriate to be before the court. You can't button up what the victim wants to say in that regard, right?
Correct. And I'm not trying. If it sounds as though I'm trying to do that, I apologize because clearly the victim has every right to make statements in that regard. But what I am trying to say is that if you read the sentencing hearing and the court's comment with regard to the information that it had from U.S. Bank, it says specifically to Mr. Alexander at the time of sentencing, these various statements that have been given to me by U.S. Bank do not allow me to know your involvement but for what you've admitted to in this case, which is the $3,200.
Right, and that's what he was sentenced on and paid the restitution for, not $12,000.
Well, that's not necessarily consistent with what the court said in its post-conviction decision when it said that it was aware of the contents of his...
It had to be aware. The U.S. Bank just told him there's $12,000, I think. I mean, it may not be proven. It may not be a count to which he entered a plea, but the court certainly knew. The victim thought it was far more reaching than these two checks.
And the court also was told by Mr. Alexander himself specifically in a protected statement that he had done these additional things. And so it is the use and the reliance upon those protected statements that is a violation of his constitutional rights. And that is what we are suggesting amounts to prejudice because the court, the sentencing court, jumped the recommendation of the parties. They mutually asked to give Mr. Alexander probation. The court jumped the recommendation and gave him an illegal sentence, which has subsequently been fixed, but gave him an illegal sentence over the amount of time that he could have received, telling Mr. Alexander at the time that the PSI and what was contained in it was influential in determining his sentence.
How do you know it wasn't just the judge knew this information from two sources? One he shouldn't have known it from, and one he should, because it's the victim.
I think that goes to a problem with regard to the decision that was entered by the circuit court. If the court wants to introduce facts into the record that can be relied upon by an appellate court when making its decision as to how it reached its conclusions, it's required to state those facts in the record. All we have here is a vague assertion that I already knew about it. But the position that we're taking is that you cannot both at sentencing say, I don't know how you're involved, but then later in the post-conviction decision, I already knew how you were involved. That's what we're suggesting is the discrepancy, and what fills that hole is the statements that Mr. Alexander made to his probation agent, because the court's reference in sentencing is to the information provided to it by U.S. Bank, which is the statements that Your Honor is keying on.
Could I address strategic reasons why there might not have been an objection?
Sure.
Very often evidence comes in that shouldn't have come in, but there isn't an objection because that draws attention to the evidence. And in this case, counsel might have thought, well, Your Honor, we object to considering all these questions about Dave's repair, all these checks about Dave's repair, that would simply have drawn attention to it.
Your Honor, I think that if the counsel had objected to those statements, the remedy would have been to give him a sentencing in front of a different judge at which those statements would have been excluded. I think that's the remedy that's been recognized, at least by the Court of Appeals in this case, saying it has to go back to a different judge who won't have access to these statements. Okay. So then you can't strategically say, I think I'm going to minimize this information.
Well, let me give you a different one then. This is Dave's repair. And was the defendant ever prosecuted for those checks?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Well, the defendant was prosecuted for those checks. If there had been more explicit discussion of those checks, he might not have been prosecuted right here in Waukesha County on those checks. Now, one of the things is that you want to put the defendant in the same position that he would have been if that document hadn't been attached to the PSI, but you want to send it back for a new sentencing. Can the convictions here in Waukesha County and those other checks be included in a new PSI?
His criminal record is, of course, part of what would be incorporated into a pre-sentence investigation, yes.
Okay, so.
But may I just, Your Honor, you said that he was convicted. Am I misinformed? Was that after his sentencing in this case?
Mm-hmm. If it had all been explicitly discussed, it might have been something that they just didn't prosecute. Of course, they probably would want to get some restitution out of him. But actually, he was prosecuted. Okay. Here, and the sentence was relatively modest.
Okay.
60 days extra.
Perhaps I'm not following the court. I don't necessarily see how that would factor into counsel's strategic choice to not object to the inclusion of the information.
Well, the strategic choice, we're talking about felonies here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He got 3 years. He was probably going to get 3 years, considering the fact that there were actually two checks, and the fellow had a long, long criminal record. Now, here are the two more checks for Dave's repair, prosecuted in Waukesha County. He gets another 60 days on that. Maybe there was a brilliant choice on the part of defense counsel to let that be considered by the court.
Because
they're not soft here. The judges in Waukesha County aren't soft on forgery.
So the inclusion of the statements in the PSI allowed him to be prosecuted in a jurisdiction that, for a felony offense, in a jurisdiction that was lenient? Is that what you're saying?
No. what I'm saying is if these offenses, these uncharged offenses, had been fully considered by the court in Milwaukee County, it might benefit him if there was a second separate prosecution for those checks.
So the idea then is that at the subsequent prosecution for the yet uncharged criminal offenses, his defense counsel could argue to the then sentencing judge, Mr. Alexander should get a lenient sentence because the sentencing judge in Milwaukee County considered these acts at the time?
Yeah. Your Honor, this information shouldn't have been before the court in Milwaukee County, but inadvertently it got there. It was considered by the court, so let's not hit the poor defendant another time.
I guess just to play this out, if he was being prosecuted at the time for those offenses, perhaps it was in the counsel's mind at the time to make that choice, but to suggest that counsel made this decision because he anticipated the future prosecution in a criminal offense, I think is well beyond the record.
What's well beyond the record? I'm speculating.
Mm-hmm.
But don't inquiring minds want to know what counsel was thinking?
I don't see how it would be helpful, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't, you know, we know from the Supreme Court of the United States that we're not supposed to engage in post hoc rationalization for decisions that counsel may have made. We're not supposed to sit around and try to dream up reasons that maybe it was a good choice. We're not supposed to try to make strategic decisions on counsel's behalf, but rather we are supposed to take the reasons that exist and determine whether they're objectively reasonable. And the fact of the matter is that in this situation, what objectively reasonable basis could be given? From what we know in the record, that could possibly justify the allowance of that material in?
Well, it seems to me you're trying to argue to the court, you are arguing to the court, that Judge Wagner did not know about these checks from Dave's machine repair. And I don't think it is reasonable to infer that those checks were cashed with U.S. Bank. Because why Mr. Harlan Peterson would have known that?
Your Honor,
if they'd been made out to the defendant and cashed at U.S. Bank. In fact, the details really imply that they were cashed somewhere else.
I am not arguing to this court that the sentencing court wasn't aware of those. The inclusion of those statements in the PSI and the court's reliance on the PSI is clearly demonstrative of the fact that the court would have been aware of them, but was aware of them by Mr. Alexander's statement. And that is the violation that we're... But let me just briefly say...
How is the court aware that by virtue of Mr. Peterson's... Or you said Mr.
Alexander's own protected statements are the statements that describe to the court the additional fraud against Dave's machine repair and David J. Frank.
But trial counsel, I think, would have known that this is a whole separate matter. Different bank, different checks, different county. And maybe he could be helpful. I mean, okay. It's pure speculation, sure. But there was knowledge at the time, and it seems to me reasonable that before we make a definitive judgment on ineffective assistance of counsel, we know what trial counsel was thinking.
And let me just say to the whole court that if it feels as though it needs those questions answered, and that it wants to know the reasons and it has to know them before it can reach the issue and decide it, that obviously Mr. Alexander would join in the state and say that you send his case back for an evidentiary hearing at which it can be litigated. We've taken the position, and I still believe, that this court doesn't need to have that hearing. However, if you're in disagreement with me, then two things. One, you can send it back and an evidentiary hearing can be held. Alternatively, the case can be decided on the ground of plain error, which doesn't necessitate understanding why counsel made the decision that he did or didn't do.
Can I ask you just a practical question? I'm the trial court judge. I'm sentencing this person. I'm sentencing this person for two checks that total about $3,000. I have a victim who comes in and says there's over $9,000 attributable to this person and some others that he hangs with. I have another person who says, no, it's $12,000 that's attributable to this defendant and his accomplices. As a judge, I think it would be reasonable to say, wait, before we go forward, I need to sort out what's going on here. Is it $3,000 or $12,000? We've got to be able to know what we're dealing with. How does that question get answered for the court?
Your Honor, I would agree that I think it's a reasonable question to pose to defense counsel for a circuit court that seems to have been as confused as the one in this case, to ask either the defendant or defense counsel what of this is his alone? I think that's particularly wise, especially when you're sentencing someone, instead of trying to lump them all together, the individual and the ring. So, yes, I agree with Your Honor that it would have been wise, and for the sentencing court in this particular case, to inquire of defense counsel, you know, explain to me what precisely Mr. Alexander is responsible for here.
Well, I think the question more likely would be, they say it's 12,000, you're saying it's 3,000, what is it? And then what's counsel going to do?
And
they can't lie to the court.
And the blank in this case was filled in by the protected statements that were attached to Mr. Alexander's PSI that include a detailed description of him, of the additional crimes that allowed
You just say, Judge, that's protected, I can't tell you the answer?
I think so. I mean, Mr. Alexander is going to otherwise be admitting that he's committed all these additional crimes, or you have a court that's uncertain as to what's going on and maybe decides to approach it differently. We know that the court jumped the recommendation. I mean, that is demonstrative of the prejudice that Mr. Alexander suffered because the parties mutually recommended probation. The agent, the person who wrote the PSI, consulted those protected statements, told the court, no, he needs to go to prison, and the court sentenced him consistent with the recommendation of the PSI writer, which was actually an illegal sentence. Now, I've also asked, I'm sorry, Your Honor, do you have...
Well, I was going to say, I got from the briefs this concept, or this idea, that the trial court was shading its responses. The first time it says one thing at the post-conviction hearing, and then at the it says another thing at sentencing versus post-conviction, and that the Court of Appeals aren't bound by what the trial court says it thought.
That's correct. The standard for clear error and the standard of review applicable here allows the court to parse the record to determine whether or not the court is correct in its statements.
So then you want us to look at the record to see what the trial court knew and from what pieces of what documentation and when did it know it?
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
Can I ask you another practical question? We write this opinion, we go your way, it goes back down in front of another judge for resentencing. We assume that judge is going to read our opinion. Our opinion is going to say, right, that this judge relied upon the things the judge shouldn't have relied upon, and therefore this judge, the sentence needs to be redone in front of a new judge. But then the new judge, by reading our opinion, knows the same thing the other judge knew.
Your Honor, I think that's a very adroit consideration.
And it's one that, how do you get
it's
beyond
one,
that?
It's one that I have struggled with in other cases that I presently am dealing with, in which you have a sentencing hearing. Apparently, it's a rife problem, at least in Dodge County, for them to incorporate these statements into their PSIs. And at a hearing I was recently at, both the state and the court seem to think that that was appropriate, although we have clear law from this court that says you can't. But the question becomes, if I got a sentencing hearing in front of a new judge, as you point out, how do we prevent the court from, how do you unring that bell? And if it hadn't been on appeal, if it was decided below, arguably one could ask for the material to be sealed or otherwise excised from the record and somehow, or stricken somehow under a rule of the judge that would prevent the next circuit court judge from seeing it. How to deal with that on appeal is something I'll leave to the wise discretion of Your Honor, and I unfortunately don't have a remedy. But I do think that it's a constitutional right that's been violated. That everyone seems to agree has been violated. The state has said in its briefing that these are protected statements, that it was error, that the court shouldn't have considered this information. If
Well, one of the fictions in law is that juries and judges know things and they can be told, just forget it. Wipe that out of your head because it shouldn't have been introduced. Do that all the time, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And expect that they will do it.
Yes.
So if you tell the judge on resentencing you can't consider A, B, and C, one assumes the judge will not consider A, B, and C. The issue here is that it seems to me you're arguing that the judge did consider A, B, and C, which the judge shouldn't have considered, and that was the error.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So when you send it back, that the new judge will know A, B, and C, but it's told not to consider it. You trust the judge not to consider it.
And to follow this court's orders.
And follow this court's orders.
Yes, Your Honor.
To the extent humanly possible.
Indeed. My time is up. Thank you very much.
You must be thankful for that.
I think there's a significant question here about whether the circuit court actually considered those compelled statements in the PSI in its sentencing rationale. The PSI writer certainly included those and made a reference in the body of the PSI to the fact that those statements were being included, but those statements were never discussed in the body of the PSI. When the PSI writer made her recommendation as to the sentence to be imposed, she never said that she was basing it on any of those statements. What she was basing her recommendation on was the fact that Mr. Alexander had a significant prior record. When you look at the judge's sentencing rationale, there is no reference whatsoever to those two statements that are attached to the PSI. How can we say the judge considered anything in the PSI when there is no reference by the PSI writer to those statements, no reference by the judge, the sentencing judge, to those statements? Now, the Court of Appeals said, oh, well, of course the trial judge, the circuit judge, considered those statements because look at all the references to the PSI. Well, yeah, there were references to the PSI. But what parts of the PSI? Not to those compelled statements. There were references to the body of the PSI that did not mention those statements in any way. Now, I don't think we can say here that that the circuit court, in fact, considered those compelled statements in fashioning the sentence that it imposed on Mr. Alexander.
Then there's no error, right?
I don't think there is.
Does that go to error or prejudice? In your brief, I understood you to argue it on prejudice.
It depends on how we approach the problem. If we approach the problem as an ineffective assistance claim, it goes to the question of prejudice.
But if you look at whether he erred or not.
But if you look at whether he erred or not by considering wrongful information in the PSI, then it's a question of no error. It's just what is the analysis? How do you approach the problem?
Who has the different burden? Ineffective assistance of counsel, of course, is the defendant. If you go just with the error, who has the burden and what is it?
The burden would be on the state to show the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the usual. If there's an error, yes.
Who's got to prove there is an error?
Yeah, if there's an error, the burden would be on the state to prove it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Who's got to prove there is an error?
The defendant has to prove there's an error, of course, not the state. So counsel made a statement that I think was very interesting, and I think it goes to the heart of the problem in this case. He said, and this is a paraphrase, I can't quote him exactly, but he said, paraphrasing, if you look at the record that we have in this case right now, it does not appear that there was any basis for a strategic decision not to object. And that is what I consider to be the heart of the problem. On the basis of this record, we don't know whether there was a basis, whether counsel had a basis for declining to object. I have indicated that perhaps there was a reason for a strategic decision not to object, and that was to use the defendant's admissions of other conduct as a showing that he was contrite, he was accepting responsibility for everything he did wrong, he was well on his way to rehabilitation, and he did not need a lengthy sentence to effect his rehabilitation. That is supported by the defendant's own statement in his allocution when he said, I accepted responsibility here. I know I did wrong. I screwed up. And judge, I'm not going to do this again. If we're going to go on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel, we need a hearing to flesh all of that out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Thank you, Mr. Penix, for your arguments today on ineffective assistance of counsel, plain error, and the Mockner hearing, all issues that we have faced in other cases in other fact situations. That concludes our hearing in 2013 AP 843 CR, State versus Danny Robert Alexander.